I thought we needed that kind of breath meditation today, reading Leviticus and Matthew's text on being what holy looks like. When I went through seminary, I had to have a little support group to read the book of Leviticus. I don't know how many of you have read it, but it's got all the abominations in it. And there's a whole lot. They went overboard with the abominations. And it was for a different time and a different people who had come through the wilderness and were growing into the people of God, a nation of Israel eventually. And it was about how to take care of their camp, literally, and not profane their camp. And it was about how to protect the relationship with God, the holy inside, how to protect the relationship with the sanctuary, which is a building, and it's also the land. And it's written for, the book of Leviticus is written mainly as a manual for the high priests of the temple and what they were supposed to teach the people. So the language is sometimes hyperbolic. It's sometimes over the top from what we would think. But today's reading is really pretty tame, I think. We're at the end of the season of Epiphany, a time of light in which God with us is made manifest in the world. And so the readings both show how God is made manifest in and through God's people. In our faith story today, Jesus is waking up a generation of people for whom the letter of the law, rather than the intention behind the law, has been used against the majority by a small minority of government and temple elites. Now, listen to Leviticus, and I bet you it's been a long time maybe since you heard Leviticus or Matthew read through the lens of what's happening in the world today, but there's certainly some wise advice there for us to heed. Jesus insists on interpreting the law from what can be discerned of God's intent or will for humanity. Jesus expands or reframes what's been the traditional interpretation, always making God bigger, the understanding of grace larger. Here, as in the last two Sundays, gospel readings were reminded in these Sundays after Epiphany that Jesus is always revealing the still speaking, still unfolding God in Jesus's context and in ours today. Jesus holds a mirror up for us to see ourselves and our world in the story that he spins out. Our quest as disciples of Jesus today is to continue to listen for and to that still speaking God, not the literal word on the page, but that still speaking God within and beyond our faith traditions. In the book of Leviticus, God says to Moses, "Speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel, that is to everyone, and say to everyone, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" Not just to the high priest, but to everyone. We have today this image up here that is taken from February 1st, 1960, when four African American college students sat down at a lunch counter at Woolworth's in Greensboro, North Carolina, and politely asked for service, knowing that they would be refused, prepared to stay in their bodies and not turn to violence, as they would surely be treated in violence. Of course, their request was refused, and when asked to leave, they remained in their seats and were beaten brutally. Their passive resistance and peaceful sit-in demand helped ignite a youth-led movement to challenge racial inequality throughout the South and still inspires us today. Four people being holy, living into their God-given potential, and responding to Jesus's teaching of not to respond to violence with violence. The whole subject of holiness can make us feel uncomfortable. It seems unattainable to be holy until you sit down and really listen to what Leviticus is saying. Everyone knows that God is holy, but we have a pretty good sense that most of us are not that holy or not holy enough. In fact, our discomfort on the matter has become a commonly understood expression of disdain, holy rollers, right? Or holier than thou. We don't hear that too much in this church. I have to think about that. Except For those in holiness church traditions, most of us think true holiness is reserved for a few exceptional people of faith, like Mother Teresa or the Pope or the Dalai Lama or our great-great-grandmother or someone that was far better than we could ever imagine ourselves to be. Holy people live far removed from us and do with their lives things that we cannot or likely will not do with ours. And as appropriately modest as that may be, it's also a way of letting ourselves off of the holiness hook, because we're called, all of us, to be holy. The passage words are, "You shall be holy," and the word in Hebrew is a modal verb, which is used to say something that certainly will or must happen. So it's not that we have a choice. We will or must be holy. We are born with holiness, and we are called to live into that holiness every day of our lives. And some days we're better at it than not. And the you shall be holy, is said to all of God's people, not to one individual who should feel badly about themselves if they're not holy enough. It's about God's people are called to be holy as God is holy, to reflect back God's love for them in and through their lives. Being holy is what any person created in God's image is called to be, or better put, to do. In Leviticus and in Matthew, holiness is not characterized by this ethereal state of being, but how one acts in everyday places and relationship. Leviticus text is concerned with congruency between your internal integrity and the outward behavior in everyday life. How many of us believe one thing and hold ourselves accountable to one thing, but we don't live that out? How many of our churches say that we are one thing and we aspire to that one thing, and you can't notice that it's lived out in our church? Being holy is what we do in everyday places and relationships, having congruency between that internal integrity and outward behavior in daily life. Leviticus says that that's to happen in the home and in the field, in our words to God and in our words to each other, in the neighborhood and in the courtroom, and how we honor and respect those among whom we live, and how the conditions of our heart affects the quality of our relationships. I want to say that one again. How the condition of our hearts affects the quality of our relationships. You know the times that the quality of your heart, the condition of your heart, has affected your relationship, right? If your heart isn't right within you, if your sense of personal integrity isn't in sync with what you believe you should be, if your relationship with God isn't what you hope or want it to be, it plays out in how we are with other people and in the world. The settings may be wide-ranging, but the common concern in Leviticus isn't the letter of the law, but a concern for the love of neighbor. All three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, quote Leviticus and say, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," where Jesus makes it clear that loving one's neighbor reflects God's love for us and vice versa. Our text from Leviticus doesn't just matter in church. And you know how some people are only holy in church? It's everywhere. It also crosses economic divides, racial divides. All people are called to love their neighbor as their self. That right relationship involves everyone, the stranger. Think about this with who's being listened to today. The laborer, people made poor, not by God, but by people, people who are deaf, people who are blind, differently abled, people made rich, not by God, but by other people, people who are your kin. Sometimes that's the hardest. People who are your community members. The laws deal with one's relationship with these diverse groups, cutting across economic and familial and ability lines. The laws are interpreted through the lens of just and loving relationship. In Hebrew, the word that's typically translated as neighbor doesn't carry that explicitly geographic association. It's not necessary that the one whom you live beside or across, it's not necessarily the one whom you live beside or across from or on the same street or across the alley from. It's not necessary the people, it's not necessarily the people on your side of town or even those within your city. Our neighbor is the one we come in contact with in our everyday lives. A neighbor is a companion, a friend, a coworker, a person in the next pew, a person on the bus or in the grocery store checkout line. Our neighbor is one with or among whom we, comfortably or not, live. Matthew's Jesus echoes Leviticus in his Sermon on the Mount to his disciples and his ragtag group of followers gathered around him, calling them to be perfect or holy as Abba God in heaven is perfect or holy. We have a hard time being perfect, and it's really impossible to be perfect. But like I said to the kids, the words that are translated into what we know in the Bible as one word often really meant originally something very different. But it depends on the culture and context of the one who is translating. Perfect derives from the Greek word telos, which means goal or end or purpose. The sense of the word is more about becoming what is intended or living into one's God-given purpose in the same way that God constantly reflects God's own nature and purpose. To be perfect is to be whole, to be complete. That's a goal which takes a lifetime and more to get to, doesn't it? What would it mean to see yourself as a whole human being living into your God-given potential and to see others as whole human beings, perfect, living into their God-given potential? What would it mean if you looked at your spouse or your partner or your workmate or that person that you have an argument with every time you sit down to a meal and said, that person is whole, that person is living into their perfection, their God-given potential? How would we treat each other differently if we saw each other the way God sees us? Following Jesus means practicing nonviolence, which is not the same as passivity. Following Jesus means that we meet up with those with whom we'd rather not deal, speak to, or listen to, let alone sit down at the same table. Following Jesus means finding ourselves outside our immediate circles of comfort and comfort zones. Following Jesus means sharing the kingdom of heaven with those you'd rather leave behind. I had to live with them my whole life. I really don't want to go into the next life with them. Jesus repeats the formula. You've heard it said, but I say to you. Jesus is always enlarging the vision behind the law. For Jesus, there is no insider or outsider or chosen and left out. I want to say a little something about that practice of nonviolence, because one of the little girls in the first service questioned it about turning the other cheek when someone slaps you. In Jesus' day, to slap a subordinate was to slap backhanded. So if you slapped somebody, you slapped their right cheek. And Jesus was saying to turn your left cheek so that person would have to slap you with their open hand, which is the way they would slap someone of their equal level and power. So it is restoring or maintaining the dignity of the person being slapped. It's not being passive and saying, oh, hit me again. It's saying, if you're going to hit me, you hit me like a human being that's equal with you. And when a person is ordered by a judge to give away their shirt, to give away their coat too, means that in Jesus' time, when people who were poor were forced to give something up or pay a fine that they had no means of paying, they would make that even more explicit by giving away their coat too, so that everyone there watching would know that their verdict or their, you know what I'm saying, whatever, was unjust, what they were being called to do. So it's not about passivity. And then there's the place that says don't return violence with violence. And this passage has been used a lot to tell people who are in abusive relationships, elders or women or children, that they should stay in a relationship and turn the other cheek. And it's certainly not about that. It's about resistance. It's about standing up for the human dignity of the person. And it's about getting the heck out of there if there's a bully in the room and that person can't be restrained. It's about taking care of ourselves and our communities so the bullies don't have the power to do the harm that they would do to the community. From the beginning of his ministry, Jesus sought to bring together what's been divided, always pulling people together. He wasn't trying to balance the opposites. He wasn't trying to teach us to see one another as separate but equal and to encourage us to practice greater tolerance and acceptance. Jesus doesn't just hope that we will eventually learn to accept our differences and put up with those who annoy us or undermine us. Jesus seeks something much deeper, something that will reveal more truly who God is, that we will become something new entirely. Jesus wants us to stop trying to find the perfect balance among all persons' perceptions and opinions. Jesus wants us to stop reacting to violence with violence. Jesus wants us to live together messily, clumsily, in the communal commitment to be holy together, to heal the divides and be a sign to the world that being holy is possible. Because in the end, it is the reality of personal relationships that saves everything. Amen.